Tonight on Arena, Conor McPherson directs his award-winning play The Weir for the first time ever, and Aidan Kelly's new photographic exhibition celebrating his love of Dublin City. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In what is set to be one of Irish theatre's highlights this summer, Conor McPherson directs his own play, The Weir, for the first time ever. The show opens at 3 Olympia Theatre in Dublin on the 13th of August. It stars, wait for this cast, Brendan Gleeson, Tom Vaughan Lawler, Sean McGinley, Owen McDonald, Kate Phillips, all of them directed by Conor McPherson. The Weir, in some ways, it's a very straightforward story. A crowd of people get into a pub, they have a few chats, they tell a few stories, and then they go home. Yeah. It's that straightforward, Conor McPherson.
It is, yes. It's set in a bar in rural Leitrim or Sligo. It's slightly indeterminate, but it's that part of the world. And yes, it's just takes place over one evening. And in this bar, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. The people who live around there, they have, I guess, lonely enough kind of lives, and they come into this pub and their social life would revolve around it. And it's just men, really, who come in and out. And on this particular evening, one of their friends who has moved into the town and done very well for himself has managed to sell a house locally to a woman, a single woman, from Dublin, and she's moving into the area, and he's bringing her in to meet the locals. And of course the energy and the anticipation is through the roof. So when she walks in, you know, it all kicks off in how they try to impress her. They begin to tell her stories about the area, and that drifts into supernatural stories. But she has a story of her own. And so that's kind of the shape of the evening, yes.
Yeah, and one of the things I remember from a couple of different productions that I've seen along the way is that, you know, the first guy who arrives in, which is the Brendan Gleeson character, isn't it? Yeah, Jack arrives in. Yeah. I think we might have seen Brendan the barman, played by Owen McDonald. We might have seen him kind of doing stuff and then he goes off. But Jack comes in, pours himself a drink, puts the money in the till and sits down. He's that at home in the place. It's more than just a local pub. It really is a little gathering with Jack, and then a pal of his, Jim, comes in later on.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this place is essential to these people's ability to be able to communicate with their other friends in the area. They'd be lost without this place. So it is that kind of place where, yes, we see Jack arrive, played by Brendan Gleeson. He comes in, there's nobody there, there's nobody behind the bar, there's just nobody there. The bar is kind of part of a farm, really, and Brendan, who runs it, is kind of off looking after his cows.
Doing something else, yeah.
And he's, you know, so Jack goes in just behind the bar to pour himself a pint, but the Guinness tap is not working, so he has to fooster around and get himself a bottle, and he's not used to that, and he gets it, and then he turns, puts his money into the till and all that. So that's kind of how the play starts, just watching this one person figure out a bar, I guess, yeah.
And what, as again, what has struck me reading both reading the script and seeing different productions, Sean McGinley then comes in as the character Jim, who's a little bit more taciturn perhaps than the other fellas. He takes him a little bit while to warm up, and later on then we get the new energy with the local fella bringing in the woman who sold the house. Then he's kind of wide by, might be a bit unfair, but he's certainly a bit flashier than the men that are in the bar. But what strikes me about it is, in some ways, nothing happens. Now, they do tell stories, you know, and the stories are both funny at times, frightening at times, slightly dark edge to them, and deeply moving at times, depending on who's telling the story. But that must have been quite a challenge in the writing to say, I'll just have these fellas, and even when the person comes in, the woman comes in, I'll just have them sitting down, chatting to each other the way you would in the pub.
Yes, well, I remember when I was a student in UCD and we were in the Drama Society, there was a drama festival every year where all the different colleges would get together and do plays. And we were lucky enough to see a brilliant production of Tom Murphy's play Conversations on a Homecoming, which of course just all takes place in a bar. And it was in Players in Trinity, I remember, and you were very much just kind of almost in the bar with them, just the way it was designed. And that really inspired me to think about a play that was like that. But another big influence on it was the Canterbury Tales, where a bunch of people come together and exchange stories, almost competitively, really, but also just in a way of sharing. I just felt that it would say something about the characters and who they were. And so it was really a culmination of those two ideas, really, you know?
Yeah, and at that point, when you first wrote the play, you'd written, I think most, if not all, of your plays at that point had been monologues. And into this then, yes, there are monologue elements within this, in that they all tell, well, they don't all tell a story. I think Jack tells two, the barman doesn't tell any, and everybody else tells one. But did it feel like a big shift that you had the characters both talking to each other and this, in inverted commas, these monologue moments within it?
Well, when I started writing plays, I was only 17 or 18, and a lot of those plays were imitations very much of kind of American plays, perhaps like Arthur Miller's plays or David Mamet. And so they had a lot of dialogue. But then when I left college and we started doing plays like on the fringe and around Dublin and in pubs and stuff like that, really, I found that doing monologue plays where you just had one character or maybe a couple of different characters just telling the audience a story was a very doable way.
It was a practical thing as much as anything
else. It was very practical and it was very doable and it was also very immediate. Like, and I found that writing those particular things, I was good at it. You know, I could write stories that people would actually really listen to and want to find out what would happen next.
And the other thing you did in those monologues, if I might say, is that it wasn't as if, oh, these are all Conor McPherson in some other form, you know.
Yeah.
They were very different characters that we met through those monologues. Very different characters.
Right, yeah, that's right. So I even found myself writing for people who are much older than me, actually. And so that was a lot of fun. So when it came to doing The Weir, I remember I had just done a play with Brian Cox in London, and it was a monologue called St. Nicholas, which was about a theatre critic who ends up working for a coven of vampires. In London. And
what do you mean he ends up? He started working with a coven.
No comment. But I was talking to the Royal Court. I did that play at the Bush Theatre and I was talking to the Royal Court and they said, well, do you have anything else? If we won't do this one, if you want to do it at the Bush. And they wanted to do this Lime Tree Bower, which I also did at the Bush. Yeah. So then I said, well, look, I have an idea for something else. And they said, what is it? And I said, well, it's people telling each other ghost stories in a pub. And they said, okay, well, will you write that one? So I sort of had already, I think, kind of written it. And I remember I wrote the play in about 10 days or so, really, just handwritten. And pretty much the play as it is now is more or less that first draft. And I didn't even type it. I got my sister, I asked my younger sister, Margaret, to type it up for me. And I remember I gave her £100.
Please say that you also give her, and for every time this is performed, Margaret, you get a few bob.
No, I didn't.
It was a buyout.
No, I didn't, to be honest with you. But this is the thing too. When we did, when the Royal Court said, oh, this is great, we love this play, let's do it. It was supposed to run for 3 or 4 weeks. And it was in a 60-seat little kind of venue, bit like in Players when we saw Conversations on a Homecoming, where the audience were pretty much in an L shape around the action. So it was like being very close to the actors, like being with them. And it was only supposed to be for 3 or 4 weeks. So I had no idea it was going to ever continue after that. But then they rang me to say they were going to extend it for a few weeks, and then they rang me to say they were going to move it into another theatre, and then they moved it into the Duke of York's, and it stayed there for about 2.5 years.
And it went to Broadway, and huge awards all along the way for you and for those involved in that first production.
But all completely unplanned.
I'm sure you didn't plan that it would run for 4 weeks, and you might have hoped, but
exactly.
People would have said, "Do you really think that'll happen, Conor?" You know,
I know.
But you have to hope that things are a success. Yeah. And this is The Weir. Is it the most successful of your plays in those terms, would you say, in terms of, you know, the longevity? Because I know we celebrated the 25th anniversary of the play, I think, with the production that happened in the Abbey a couple of years back.
It always seems to be on somewhere all the time. It just never seems to not be on somewhere in the world. So it just always seems, I don't know, it struck a certain chord. My other plays do always, get produced, but The Weir just always seems to be on somewhere. It's completely out of my hands in that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I would say it's the one. I remember in the years after the Weir had happened, like say in the next 3 or 4 years, and people would still keep talking about the Weir, and I was like, yeah, but I've got a new play, you know. But you know, but it's the wonderful thing about it happening when I was very young, and I was only like 25 or so, was that I've been able to enjoy watching its journey over all these years. But it's nearly 30 years since I wrote it. I can hardly believe I'm saying that.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, it's only 30 minutes ago. I'm still right there.
Yeah, I think we all have that feeling around certain parts of our lives.
Exactly.
And yet I was astonished, because you've often directed your own work. And I'm sure in those early years, a bit like the monologue aspect of things, that was a practical thing. It made sense for you to direct it because you didn't have to go hiring a gun to literally get a hired gun to direct it. You could do it yourself. And it was probably, I'm sure, a shorthand there. This is your first time, is that right, to direct The Weir?
Yes, I mean,
I am astonished at that.
Well, The Weir was an anomaly for me in that, as you say, out of practicality, I'd always been directing my plays just because we were always doing them ourselves. It was very much a DIY operation. But when I was going to go on at the Royal Court, they asked would Ian Rickson direct it, who was an associate director there at the time. And I met with Ian and we got on really great. And that was fantastic. You know, it really was a great relationship. And he was very open. He wanted me at all the auditions, and he wanted me there at the rehearsals. And so it was very organic, and it was great in that way. But then I was always busy doing something else.
You were writing other plays
other
as well.
Plays and directing them. Yeah. So off I went. So yes, it was just then in the last year or two, when I was approached by Kate Horton, who's a producer from London, who was working with Dominic Cook over there, and Anne Clark here.
With Landmark Productions.
With Landmark Productions, and they were asking, would we do it and would I direct it? And we talked about it, and I said, well, that would be really fantastic. And we said, well, who will we go to? And of course, top of the list was a certain Mr. Gleeson. So we sent him the play, and very fortunately for me, he just turned around and said he'd love to do it, and off we went.
But as I said, I mean, Brendan Gleeson at the top of the list there for sure.
Yeah.
Owen McDonald as the barman, Brendan, Sean McGinley as Jim, Kate Phillips as Valerie, the woman who comes in, and Tom Von Lawler as Finbar, the white guy, the white boy, as I'm referring to him. I mean, it is a phenomenal cast. When you come to this point, then, you know, clearly you know the play intimately. You've seen, I'm sure, numerous productions of the play, some of which you've loved, some of which you may not have loved quite so much. That's by the by. Did Conor McPherson, director, look at anything that Conor McPherson, writer, had done and say, I might have to ask him a bit. I might have to ask him to change that or to look at that again?
Well, the reason I direct my plays is precisely for that reason, in that very quickly you can see where the problems are. Very quickly you can see what actors just solve without even a lot of effort. But also very quickly you can change things and suggest things and, you know, make them happen quite efficiently. So in this rehearsal room with these amazing performers, we're always tempted to try stuff and we're always messing around. And so it's very pleasurable in that way.
Yeah.
And so we're having a very nice time. But I would see it very much as like an organic process like that. I'm not married to anything particularly. I think in some ways, actors often, when I'm working with them, they're more intent on trying to make sure that everything is done properly. I'm a little bit more anarchic, to be honest with you. I'm usually looking for some other, how far else can we push this?
Yeah.
And so it's, in that way, it's very alive and it's a lot of fun.
And I guess, again, with that bundle of actors playing, literally playing in the rehearsal room or the playroom, if we want to call it that, you know, you can do things that are crazy that everybody knows, well, that's never going to see the light of day on stage.
Right.
But somehow it informs what happens on stage, even if you pull way, way back from it.
That's right. And I do say to them, you know, go big, go there, because at least we'll find something out that's underneath the words and underneath the action, which is always really important. The subtext is really what you're always digging for, because that's the foundation for the actors to have those strong, deep roots then allows them to, as you say, be playful all the time and to keep it alive, and so that every night is always a little bit different, like playing music. It's always a little bit different, but it keeps it very much alive for them and keeps them engaged and the audience feeling like something new is always happening, because it really is.
You've always got something on somewhere. Is The Brightening Air, which was your last play, is that still running now in London, or has that run finished? Because was it April it opened in sometime around?
The Brightening Air is just finished at the Old Vic Theatre, but it was then replaced by another one of my plays, Girl from the North Country, which is now on at the Old Vic Theatre. Yeah,
so, and Girl from the North Country, of course, is the musical, or a story told using the music of Bob Dylan. Is that a fair way to describe it?
That's right, yeah. I was asked, would I use Bob Dylan's music in a show, and I wasn't sure what to do. But then I had the idea of having a show set in the 1930s, like a Eugene O'Neill play, really. And I set it in Minnesota in the 1930s. And so Girl from the North Country uses Bob Dylan's music to tell that story. So that's running now at the Old Vic Theatre. So, yeah.
So you finished one play in the Old Vic Theatre. Then Girl from the North Country comes into the Old Vic Theatre. Then you're directing The Weir here in Dublin, which subsequently will go to the West End. That West End, well, I suppose that's part of the other producer, the English side of the equation.
Yes.
In the production.
Yes.
I mean, that's phenomenal to have that kind of lined up like that.
It is. Well, it's never planned. I mean, as you know, Sean, in this game, you know, it can all seem like there's nothing happening, and then suddenly all the buses crash into each other and arrive at once.
Yeah. Well, the guaranteed way, they used to say, for an actor to get a job was to book a holiday.
Exactly.
You'll get one the next day. Exactly. It will clash with your holiday.
Or suddenly get offered another job that they wanted at the same time, you know. So it's a bit like that. So, yes, this play, The Weir, goes to the Harold Pinter Theatre in September. And then after that, we have an adaptation of The Hunger Games, which is opening in October, which I've adapted, the first book of The Hunger Games. So that's next up.
And if you've adapted the first book, that sounds like there might be some kind of plan there to adapt further, is there?
I really don't know at this stage. It's such a big undertaking. They're actually building a theatre for it in Canary Wharf. So that's being built at the moment, and that goes into rehearsals in August. Thankfully, I'm not directing it, but yes. So it's
you'd be directing something else at that.
Hopefully, no. Hopefully, I'll be in there helping them. But yeah. So it's just the way it turns out sometimes.
When you look back now, 30 years, and it's actually 30 plus years that you've been writing plays. Let's face it. Can you begin to see some kind of shape, or you know, set of themes or set of aspects to your work that you go, I didn't know I was doing that at the time. And I can see now when I look at those first 5, 6, 7, whatever number of plays, I can see a pattern there that I didn't even know was happening.
It's very strange. I think writing plays is such a unusual thing to do anyway. It's not so much a decision as a kind of a weird vocation, probably. It comes and grabs you rather than you going to it. And that it even works at all is then even more kind of astonishing and unlikely. But anything that I would see that is a common thread going through all my work is that it's trying to reach for something else. It's trying to reach for something beyond the play. It's trying to reach for some feeling between the audience, the play, me and the performers, which is somehow akin to like when you play a note on the piano. It's not the physical pressure of your fingers on the keys that you want to watch. It's the vibration in the air that occurs. And it's that sort of unseen, mysterious other thing happening, this other hopefully effect that kind of, I guess, inspires people or provokes something that you can't even quite name it, but it's aiming to express the feeling of being alive and the mystery of being alive somehow. I see that being a kind of a, you know, I'm reaching for it all the time, never quite getting there. Sometimes it kind of happens and you're always just then moving forward. So I see that pattern, but it's again, as I say, it's hardly even barely conscious. Yeah. You're sort of in the grip of it.
Yeah, and I suppose one other thing I just wanted to ask you about, because what you're describing there to me sounds as if it couldn't be anything other than live performance and live theatre. In recent years, I suppose in the last decade, if just to put that on it, maybe a bit longer, the long form television, it struck me on more than one occasion, it's kind of taken a place, or it's doing things now that I feel maybe 25 years ago theatre was doing. It seems to have a central role in terms of social commentary, in terms of themes that might interest us in a wider way. Do you see anything? Would you be interested in writing in that form, or is it theatre all the way and theatre's power has not been dimmed in any way?
I think for me, the power of theatre as a live ritual that you're present for means that we all enter into a kind of communal trance, which is the same as being in a church in that kind of way. It's a kind of it's a more ancient ritual. I love watching, you know, cool long form shows on TV. I think the only thing about those is that there can often be a certain sense of bad faith in that stories for me usually have a beginning, a middle and an end. I think long form seasons on television have no end. They will stop when there is no market.
And season two can come along when you think, leave it alone, finish it season one and
exactly,
stop.
Exactly, exactly. So in a sense, I think that there's a completion. There's a lovely, I always think the plays are like a little snow globe. You can pick them up and look all around them. Do you know what I mean? They're a little environment with a little weather system in there. Yeah. And so there's something about that that's very complete for me, very mysterious, very durable, which is not to say, I mean, I love watching a great TV thing like everybody else, but theatre always draws me. And I think playwrights are sort of cursed in that way. They're always going to get drawn to this rather peculiar art form, but it's wouldn't have it any other way.
And also you don't get the communal experience with the long form television. Now, it's not even like where you used to have the water cooler moment the day after the episode. Now you just watch the streaming services and you can't talk about it because the person's only on episode 3 and you've watched episode 4.
I know. Well, what's interesting too about the live experience is laughter in the theatre. Yeah. It's because people laugh for all kinds of reasons, not just because there's a funny joke, but they laugh when the story deepens. They laugh when they see something they recognise. Yeah. We laugh to communicate with each other as an audience or to communicate with the performers on stage to say sort of, keep going, yes. And that's a real strong communication, which is fantastic.
The first love is still there, obviously, totally. With the theatre very clear. Yeah. Thanks very much, Conor.
Thanks, Sean.
And Landmark Productions and Kate Horton, that was the name I was searching for with Conor there. Kate Horton Productions, in association with Three Olympia Theatre, present The Weir at Three Olympia Theatre in Dublin. It previews from the 8th of August, opens on the 13th of August and runs through until the 6th of December. But I would guess with that cast, you'd want to be very quick to get your tickets sorted, would be my advice. The show transfers to London's West End, the Harold Pinter Theatre, from the 12th of September through until the 6th of December. And you can find out full details on 3olympia.ie and landmarkproductions.ie. The grim discovery of a single bone during archaeological excavations of the Abbey Quarter in Kilkenny is in the lead up to its redevelopment has fired the imagination of an artistic team whose new work will be performed for the first time at next month's Kilkenny Arts Festival. Where We Bury the Bones is an experimental theatre work encouraging the audience to sift through evidence, piece together the past and build a picture of the present. Music has been composed for the show by Brian Irvine and soprano Megan O'Neill, both of them joining me on the line this evening. It's a great, I know there's a kind of a darkness and a grimness to the starting point to this, Brian, but it was a great moment in terms of, was it immediate with you? That's going to be a show when you heard about it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it was really about, the show is really about an exploration of the site, you know, and the history of the site from to its present state in the skateboard park, you know. So
park where you had placed an opera or certainly had an opera about the skateboard park in previous year, hadn't you?
That's right, yes. We've been working with the Kilkenny Arts Festival for a couple of years, and this is just to kind of reimagine the space that is the Skipper Park. So we did an installation, a music installation, projected installation in the Skipper Park. And this is kind of an extension of that in some ways, you know, where we really built connections with the skateboarders. You know, we collected a lot of recorded audio. We really dug into the whole site and the history of the site. You know, and very much the pieces is kind of like, the piece is almost like we're bringing the audience into our laboratory, I suppose, and we're reimagining and piecing together the history and hidden stories of that site, and you know, using actors, Megan, an ensemble, you know, recorded dialect, recorded audio, and so on. So it's like two researchers trying to find out the history and the stories behind the site, you know,
the site itself. So it is a big look back and a big look forward all at the same time.
It is. It's kind of, I mean, in many ways, it's kind of our response to it, you know. So we don't really tell linear stories, we just make the connections, and then you sort of work out you work out your own story in some ways.
That's fair enough. The audience has to do a bit of work. That's that's the gig. And Megan is well, I was going to say Megan is with you there, but in fact she's not. She's joining us from the depths of the English countryside, I'm told, this evening, currently rehearsing Henry Purcell, I don't know what way you're saying it. It varies from month to month in my world. Yeah. Dido and Aeneas, and that's at the Longborough Festival in the Cotswolds. I'll come back to that in a minute. But what Brian was saying there, Megan, it strikes me, he was saying about, you know, it's not a linear, it's not a straightforward storytelling. And in some ways, I hope I'm not giving too much away, what you do on stage, it's not as if you are a specific character. You're doing something else, I think, on stage than just simply this is me as whoever you might be telling a story. You're doing, there are whole other layers and aspects to what you're actually performing.
Yeah, so it's not like, this was my first question for Brian when we started talking about this first. I was like, what is my character? And he was kind of like, it's not really just a character, like there's so many elements to it. I suppose I'm kind of narrating like what the story of this bone could possibly be in a scientific clinical way at times, but there's also like a deep sadness to at other times. And I think it's just trying to find what the possibility could be through singing, through speaking. We've played a lot with imitation and mimicking sounds. I've worked with Brian on that for a couple of days, and so it's not very straightforward. It's not your standard go in, listen to someone singing and leave again. It's quite, I feel like the audience are going to be quite involved in trying to put the pieces together themselves, as am I still. I'm still trying to figure out where do I fit into all of this, and that's what's so exciting about it. It's very, very immersive for me, and I'm really excited to be working with both Brian and John again. It's just, it's going to be a really cool project.
Yeah, and I suppose what we're talking about there, John McElduff, by the way, is the John that you're mentioning, isn't of Dumbworld, Brian and John's company. In some ways, Brian, what we're doing, and as Megan describes it there, it's as much about creating atmosphere as it is about telling straightforward stories.
Yes, very much so. It's really about it's really about asking questions rather than sort of telling you the answers to those questions. And I think there's a sort of curious it's about the layers of history, you know, the different sort of characters that space has occupied, and there are stories embedded in those layers. So in many ways it's about unpeeling a sort of certain kind of onion, but in a way which asks you to feel things and reimagine things. All we do in the opera is we show you and tell you what we find out. And, you know, there's no invented dialogue. It's just sort of collected testimony. You know, one of the amazing things that I found out when we talked to a forensic anthropologist was that everything is post-1950 or pre-1950 when it comes to carbon dating, because there was so much nuclear testing in 1950 that the whole world changed. And there's a spike which happens in the ground and all carbon, which marks sort of 1950. So you either have that or you don't. And, you know, it just seems to be like an extraordinary kind of...
so there was a big change at that moment in time.
Exactly.
Can you tell me if the bone was post or pre 1950? Or do you mightn't want to, and that's okay.
No, the answer is we don't know, because actually when the bone was found, it was described as possible human. And then so we went on this journey about trying to find out how you define something as being human. So it goes into that sort of area.
Right into that area, rather than getting bogged down in it's from whatever date. You sent us a piece of music which is billed as the only evidence. This is from Where We Bury the Bones. Just maybe give us a little bit of context for this, if you would, Brian.
Yeah, no, this is just a little extract that Megan and I sort of put together when we were working on some of this. It's a very collaborative thing, so we've been working on some ideas. And this little section is where there's a sort of a historic document which puzzles with the idea of whether there was a holy well in the skateboard park or not. And so it's about piecing together the evidence and coming up with a sort of sense of maybe there was, maybe there wasn't.
Is the voice of Megan O'Neill there with a little section of The Only Evidence from Where We Bury the Bones. How would you describe it, Brian Irvin, if I had to say it's not an opera, it's not a stage show, it's a kind of a... what is it in those terms, if you like?
I mean, it's sort of an experimental music theatre piece. But it's, when I say that, I mean experimental in the sense of the way it's put together.
Yeah.
You know, the music is... goes from all sorts of different spaces to very beautiful things that, you know, Megan sings, to, you know, harsher things, to moves in and out of spaces. So it's experimental in the way that it's put together. A lot of the music is, I think, very exciting and, you know, it goes from poetic to challenging and so on. So,
well, I mean, that section that we were just listening to there, Megan, it can be experimental, it can be whatever it is, and you can say, I'm not telling a story. They're not making it, they're not saying to you, and we'll keep a nice little gentle notes in the middle of your range. That sounded to me, it sounded to me as if it's right up at the top end of the soprano voice, is it?
Yeah. I mean, it goes even higher, actually. We've been experimenting with every single part of the voice. But yeah, I mean, the music is challenging in itself, of course. But I think I was just thinking there when Brian was just speaking, the beauty of a project like this is playing with your voice. And it's not about sounding beautiful. It's not like you're putting on a show and trying to make this beautiful lyrical sound, which sometimes that is what the sound that
it's
makes.
It's probably what you're doing.
The text.
That's what you're doing in the Cotswolds at the moment, I'm guessing, sounding lyrical.
That's exactly. And, you know, experimentation is brilliant. You do it in all forms. But for the voice itself, it's really amazing to be able to not focus on sounding beautiful all the time and actually, like, think about what am I singing about here, and what this passage might not make sense. I don't need to do a full big sound on this. I can use this with no vibrato. I can speak this part. That's the most exciting part for me. And I think we've worked on this for 4 days musically with Brian. That was the most exciting part, was that there's so many options with this music, because it's a searching for something. I don't know what it is yet. Yeah. And it's so much fun, the colors you can make. But it is tricky at times, Brian. Brian will admit that too. There's some of it that's tricky, but we will get there.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of your late teacher, the great Mary Brennan, who was your teacher for a long time. And that's exactly, she'd be telling you, yes, there are times for the voice to be beautiful, and yes, there are times when you just go at it whatever way you want.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I actually, funny enough, you mentioned Mary. I brought the Scorched Earth trilogy, which was the first piece I did with Brian and John. I brought that to her, and you know, there was a lot of octave leaps here and there, and lots of intervals that were like tricky. And she kept saying to me, diction. So I'm kind of bringing that with me onto this this project as well. I know she'd be loving life if she could hear it, because it's so cool.
and Brian, just in terms of, obviously you have Megan's voice there, and I think Megan is pretty much, am I right in thinking she's on stage more or less all of the time? There, you mentioned actors and other instrumentations that come in and out.
Yes, we have two actors who are also dancers, Stephanie and Christian, and we have a sort of 8-piece ensemble. We have, you know, as I say, collected audio, video. There's a lot. We have a model of the area on stage, so a lot of it happens within this model. So it's basically like, it's, you know, all these ingredients are investigating this site and voice and music and sound and video in live, and also there's a little bit of AI in there as well. So so all these components, if you like, are manifestations of different kind of researchers, and we're just trying to find the heart of something. And, you know, like working with Megan is fantastic. You know, she's such an incredibly special and versatile musician, you know. So she really brings a whole other dimension to, you know, both heart and both the kind of energy and the beauty of the way she uses her voice.
Yeah, well, you can hear it in that piece that we just heard. And as I said, Megan, you're in the Cotswolds at the moment, part of the Longborough Festival, where you're singing Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. The first, if not, well, very certainly a very early opera in terms of singing, very different from the style that you're doing there. How much is it the rural and the country idyll that we think of when we think of, well, certainly when I think of Longborough and the peaceful village in the middle of Gloucestershire? Are you just out there singing in the fields, having a good time with the music of Henry Purcell?
Oh no, it's, you know what, it is so beautiful out here. And it's, so I'm currently in Longborough, and there's one pub and one shop, and then there's this beautiful theatre just up the hill, and it's gorgeous. I mean, it's a fabulous theatre, and it's like a hidden gem in the middle of the countryside. It's so spectacular to be here, but it is very different to what I'm working on in Where We Bury the Bones. So I'm trying to spend the mornings looking at that, and then we're in the afternoon evening doing Purcell. But we're also doing a race with the Brock Solison group led by Bjarte Eike. So they're also kind of this contemporary but experimental kind of group, where they're like on stage with us all the time, so we're always playing around with the musicians. So it is really interesting to be going from two different pieces, but I am finding like similarity in like the collaborative process and exploration. But I mean, in fairness, you couldn't go wrong being here. It is beautiful. It feels like a holiday and work all at the same time,
and I'm sure you would want to say that yes, Longborough is absolutely beautiful, nearly as beautiful as Kilkenny.
Nearly as beautiful as Kilkenny, but not as beautiful as Kerry, where I can't give that card out.
The Kerry woman will out.
Listen, exactly.
Lovely to speak with you both, and thanks for being with us this evening. That's composer Brian Irvine, soprano Megan O'Neill. Where We Bury the Bones, directed by John McElduff, who was Brian's partner on the it's gone out of my head now what exactly the title of the Dumb World, thank you very much, just come into my ear, Dumb World Production Company, Where We Bury the Bones, directed by John, will be performed at the Watergate Theatre in Kilkenny from the 14th through to the 16th of August. All of that as part of Kilkenny Arts Festival, which is website is kilkennyarts.ie. Photographer Aidan Kelly returns with his latest body of work, No Ordinary Love, a visual love letter to Dublin City. Launching as an exhibition in Rathfarnham Castle this month, the show takes a look at all of the tensions between nostalgia and reality, affection and frustration, and blends analogue and digital street photography. Delighted that Aidan Kelly is with me in studio this evening. And I was thinking about that title, No Ordinary Love. We were talking about some of the photographs that I would chat further to when we, as we go through our chat now, Aidan. I get the impression that you love this city, but there are times when you hate this city or get very angry at this city as well.
I kind of personified it a little bit. Like, I am in love. Mm. I am where I'm from, you know. I'm from Northside Dublin, Carborough West. I couldn't wait to get into the city. So for me, the city was about music initially, but in my bag was a camera. There was cameras in my house.
They came from your uncles, I believe.
Yeah. They were hard workers too. Bartenders, silver service waiters in places like Wynn's Hotel. They always had cameras in their bags. And for me, that was... I was an introduction to a new world. I think I had that face on me as a kid. Give that child something to do. And they handed me cameras. So.
And these, your uncles handed these? Did they show you how to use them? Did they teach you about it? Or did they just kind of let you go out and work it out for yourself?
There was a look. It was like, figure it out yourself almost. But I had Phibsborough Library. So I went and I read. And then I started taking photographs of the city that I was in the middle of all of the time, you know, with club culture and the idea of being in a port city. And I saw the city over a long period of time. And this is a show of about 30 years of photographs. It took me a long time to pick. Mm. To see a changing city and to use the cameras I got and to personify the city, I felt... In sort of a relationship way.
Yeah.
I love her. Yes, of course I love her. So Plurabella, the Joycean idea, yes, of the river. Anne Olivia. What about standing on Hill 16 and singing that Molly Malone song? You can't not but be moved by... Mm. So I did. I saw her and the way men build ships and they give them female protection to get them through tough waters. Yeah. I saw it that way.
That was the way you were looking at the city in some ways. And you have a photograph that I'm looking at on the screen here in front of me, which has that title, Anne Olivia Plurabella. Can you describe what we're looking at for the listeners at home?
Well, she's lying down.
So it's a woman lying down on the ground.
She's dressed in nines. She's got a phone in her hand. Can you see the phone?
Yeah,
she's
lovingly
admiring herself. Yeah. She's got a hammer beside her handbag.
Big sledgehammer beside her handbag, yeah.
That's a strange sounding photograph, isn't it?
Yeah.
But in a way, I believe that's the woman I'm still in love with.
This is Dublin City, as it were.
Yeah, well, the subtext is the powers that be. Can I just say that?
Mm. You can.
She's not getting back to me a little bit. She, I keep sending her messages. Some of the work I do has physical text on it to try send that message maybe... in a psychological way of like, do you still love me?
Yeah.
Because I love you. And we just need to sort of talk about it and settle our differences. And
yeah, so when you're talking about Dublin City, you're talking about, you're not talking about this woman who's lying on the ground.
No.
You're talking about the city, the powers that be, the structures that run the city.
Yeah.
And I'm going to flick down to, anybody who's driven out around in and around the Beacon has seen this...
Centennial Tower, Sandyford.
So this is a black and white shot?
It's a series of 12 black and white shots taken.
Of the empty apartment block?
Yeah. Now, 2007, they started building that, and is it still there? They haven't torn it down, no?
Well, it's still there. So, and on some of them now, I think there are kind of these false pictures. You think, oh, are there people inside? No, it's...
So they're trying to convince us that it's actually...
Well, I don't know what they're trying to convince. But there are some of them that are just lying there empty and derelict as well. And what do you hope when people... How many of those photographs did you say there are?
We're talking 40 photos out there in Rathfarnham Castle, all in three beautiful 17th century rooms. Totally different work against a totally different backdrop. But yes, like a story of this idea of why and how.
So how come we have a homeless problem and yet we have these shells of apartment blocks with nothing in them?
I keep hearing things are going great. We're going to sort all of this out. And I'm just a frustrated photographer trying to say something with a camera.
Now, having said, you have those that have the more political aspects to them, I suppose. But then you have, there are two shots in particular. First time I came to Dublin.
Really?
From Monaghan. When I came, you know.
How long ago was that?
Oh, God, I don't know when I went to college. In God's old time, I don't know, 40 years ago, something like that. So when I look at this picture, when I first arrived here, it was the light. Yeah. The light that came down the canal or came down the river.
There she
because
is.
you kind of could see at sunset and sunrise, depending on what direction you were facing. So No Ordinary Love is written across this one. It's kind of a twilight picture, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Right at the end of the day when things shift, you know. And I'm sorry, but the widest bridge in Europe, Carlisle Bridge. Everyone calls it O'Connell Bridge, but I always think
you
of Carlisle.
You still like it as Carlisle, do you?
I kind of think about Carlisle. Look, it's a nostalgic look at the city. I'm a little bit nostalgic. I'm growing up in this city and I've seen it change an awful lot. But at the same time, I think that it's a beautiful place to be at certain times of the day. And I just know that there's like a little bit of hope in that one photo, that it's not an ordinary love affair that I'm having. So...
And the other one that strikes me in terms of that light is this one you're telling, it's up around Thomas Street, somewhere up around Christchurch, is it?
No, we're on our Dame Street there.
Oh, that's Dame. Yes, now that you say Dame Street, I can see. So we're on Dame Street looking up towards Christchurch. And this is the beginning of the day, isn't
it? Well, this is April 2020, right in the middle of the pandemic.
There's nobody on the street.
Nothing on the street. So in the middle of the book, there's 16 pages dedicated to this idea. We got there and we all had time to sit around and work out what our differences were and stay in touch with people in the ways that we could. And sure, when we got back, everything would be okay, right? Right? Maybe not. I think things have gotten a little bit out of hand and I just think Dublin needs, along with many other cities in the world, a little bit of love. The Portuguese have this word about a longing for a city. The word is saudade, saudade eterna. It's like, I miss my city and I miss parts of growing up in the city. I miss the communal idea, the club culture, the possibility of that people getting on an awful lot better than we sort of seem to do sometimes. We don't need people coming into the city setting fire to buses. We need people coming into the city saying hello to each other. Like the way we get off a bus. Mm. The way we get off a bus.
And we still say thanks to the bus driver. Yeah.
Don't we say thanks?
Yeah.
Could we just not
continue?
Extend that everywhere. Mm. And that's what the photographs are about. It's just trying to start that chat.
You have a picture too, another black and white that I'm looking at on the screen now. It's the bottom of the spire on O'Connell Street. The GPO is just behind it. There we can see the Lewis line to one side of it as well. And a kind of a circular...
It's a portal.
Yeah. Oh, so that's what there's a circular line around it. So explain that to me.
The drawing is early 2007. Because sometimes I draw first, I write first, take a photograph of the writing or the drawing, and then I place it on a later photograph. I had this idea of a portal. And then, of course, somebody goes and builds one on Talbot Street.
On the other side of the road.
And I loved it, but I was like, I just wish that we could actually just go through that portal and into this other version of Dublin where things are, I don't know, more joyous or... I don't know.
Or everybody's saying thank you to the bus driver and hello to the bus driver and hello to each other, a bit of that.
I'm still searching for a resolution to this in this work. But I think the story... hits with people.
And you're talking all the time about this kind of double-edged sword in many ways. There's a great side to this love. There's also a very difficult, angry side to this love. How does that... you use both analog materials and analog equipment and digital equipment. How does that feed into that kind of that double-edged side of things, if you like?
I think there are two different mediums. I would have been brought up as a photographer that used film quite a lot.
Mm.
And then as things progressed and I got more digitized, cameras changed, I felt guilty about leaving the film behind. So I tried to put the two together. And why not? Because the colors in film are slightly different than the colors in digital. The idea of digitized handwriting, where the messages made so much sense in my head, could be easily brought across onto a photograph and then make this not a photograph technically, but like a graphic, but a message nonetheless. Keep it simple. Say how I felt, what I felt, it was about finding this like little resolution in the story that seems to be in my head all the time.
And how optimistic are you? I mean, because when I look at the world, particularly it's the light falling across Dublin, as I say, one of the first things that struck me when I arrived to go to college, it was the way the light fell across, particularly up and down the river or up and down the canals. If you were looking at those, you could see the light in the same way as the sun was setting or the sun was riding, it was rising rather. How optimistic are you? Or how pessimistic are you? Or is it a mixture of both?
No, I'm gonna go optimistic, right? I'm going to take option A in the sense that the light and that idea of Dublin City, and it fuels our imagination. You know, we're makers of stories and we write songs and we're great painters. And sure, we had Leo back in the day quoting Seamus Heaney when we needed it most. Mm. That'll be always happen.
Yeah, so and there are very few countries where at a football match, the death of a poet, an entire stadium will stand and applaud the poet. Yeah.
The inspiration is there.
Yeah.
Look at last weekend. You know, I'm not even a Tip or a Cork supporter. I'm sorry, I'm a Dub. True and true. But you can't help but be moved by the energy that we have for each other and for our own place where we come from, that what makes us the people that we are. That will always remain. I'm just saying, can it just be a little bit better? And can we look after everybody?
Yeah, and that's what the exhibition
is. Is that okay?
That's absolutely perfect. It's no ordinary love, but it's a good type of love, Aidan.
Okay.
Thanks for being with us this evening. That's Aidan Kelly, and Aidan's exhibition, No Ordinary Love, is at Rathfarnham Castle, as Aidan was saying. It's there through until the 31st of August, and you'll find out full details on AidanWilliamKelly.ie. Just before we finish, a winner of our competition: which influential big band leader was famous for hits like In the Mood and Moonlight Serenade? Glenn Miller was, of course, the answer. Jenny Brady will be heading off to the RTÉ Concert Orchestra Big Band Evolution at the National Concert Hall on Friday, August the 1st. She will also be having an overnight stay in the newly refurbished four-star Brooks Hotel nearby with bread and breakfast. Enjoy yourself, Jenny, at that evening. And that is our lot for this Monday night. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sheila O'Callaghan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.